Wally was a guy who basically I'd sort of gone to Europe with. We'd done a few projects together, and we had sort of you know, shared the herb importation business together. And so consequently, it came to a point where we were looking for some way to put something back. You know, like, you know, basically, you know, the drug business, it turned into a criminal enterprise, and we got out of it. And we had quite a bit of money, and there was a lot of, you know, sort of the scene, that we'd taken so much out of the scene. We'd done so well that we wanted to put something back. So we got an opportunity to rent this theater from the city, and we got the, we made a deal, and we got it, we got it for $500 a month, okay, and I think that included the hydro. So, so basically, we took it over, and we started to work to get it, you know, restore it, basically. And at that time, there was an enormous inventory of well-educated, hard-working, you know, very smart, you know, people on the street, or the draft dodgers. And then there was like, it started, we got the theater, and we put up a little bit of hoarding, and then there was just the entrance, right, at the theater, the foyer in the front from the street. And like this part. So we had some hoarding across the back, but this was open. And every time we'd get there in the morning, there'd be five or six or seven musicians. And they were all draft dodgers, and they were all accomplished players. And sometimes there'd be four or five people, cello, violin, you know, playing chamber music. You know, this is great. You know, do you mind if we stay here? Well, you know, no. And then at the end of the day, they'd come to us and give us part of what they collected, right? Because they were out of the rain, et cetera, et cetera. So that's when we started to recognize it was a tremendous. So we started. So then what happened was that these groups attracted other people, sympathetics who'd be watching, and then they would, you know, if we ever wanted any help, we'd say help wanted one day, you know, soup and a sandwich or something, and they would come in, and then we eventually recruited like a really top-notch staff of people, unbelievable people. I mean, we had our doorman was Ashok Fakir. He was a Brahmin poet from India, and when that the group of poets from New York, Ginsberg and Corso and all those guys, there was a promoter who had put them together as a package, and they were touring around the world, right? As, you know, as entertainment, selling tickets and doing their thing. And they went to India, and they met this Brahmin poet, right? And they just immediately said, okay, you're part of the gang. So he joined the tour. So they toured Europe, and then they came back in the States. And then they got hooked up with Leary. Timothy Leary was part of that as well, right? And then they started promoting acid, and then they got busted. And they ended up in San Francisco, right? And then Leary got busted, and the whole thing got broken up, right? And everybody was running for their lives. Well, he never had any work permits. He never had even a visa. He stuck in with this gaggle of people, right, on the tour, right? So he had to make a run for it. So he comes up here, right? And there again, there he shows up at the door, and he's got no working permit. He's got, you know, no money. He's got, you know, his daughter. He's living with his daughter, and he's got his wife with him, and they're just totally like refugees on the street, right? And the guy is so well spoken, and he's so cool. Like, he is like, I'm just astounded. I'm in the presence of a real genuine guru. And I said, I don't know who you are, but you're hired, you know. And he said, look, can you give me like $5 so I can, you know, now come right back, you know, but I've got to feed my daughter and my wife. And I said, well, yeah, take 10, you know, but $10, you could get a decent meal.
Sportsman.
Yeah, at the Sportsman, you could really nosh up, right? And sure enough, he came back, and then I found out he of course, all the information how he got there, right? And that when he really got into trouble, when he married Timothy Leary and his wife in San Francisco, he presided over the wedding or something, and then shortly thereafter he got busted, and then they were looking for him, so he had this run out. So he was running the door, and the guy was, he could control people in the strangest ways. And he was a man, he was like a magician, a poet magician. And he could transform himself. He was the master of disguise. He could transform himself right before your eyes with the simplest gestures. And, you know, it looked like a hanky. He'd pull it out, and it was actually a kerchief. He'd put it around his head. And then he'd have, like, you know, and this other thing, he'd have another little, like, a cloth, and it would be a hat. And he'd put the hat on. And he would be totally, and he'd turn it, flip up his collar. And then he had some beads he'd pull out of his pocket. And he was like, totally transformed. He was like, wow, you know, I want to confess, Father, you know. Anyway, he was such a resource. And that was like the guy at the door. And I said, look, anybody who comes along you think is okay, send them up, you know. And they're hired. You have the authority to hire anybody you want, anytime you want, and, you know. Just let me know, you know, and who's working for me, right? And he took that very seriously. He was punctual. He was, you know, basically that was that's how we sort of got started. And then part of the thing was is that we started to open, and I wanted to do film and live events, right? So we launched, I think, this was the first concert that we had there. This was our first live event. And we launched a theater, and Al Neal was there. And this is what I'm thinking to myself, well, this is a great way to launch the theater. You know, it's a launch into obscurity. Like, what am I thinking? I got this theater on Granville Street, for Pete's sakes. I'm trying to, attract a mass audience, right? I'm competing with, like, the Orpheum and, you know, and all the other Playhouse and that. And here I come up with Al Neal, you know, like, it's one of my proudest moments. I look back, it's one of my stupidest, yes, proudest moments, you know, in terms of running a business, you know, surviving on the street. And, but then that, what happened was that just put good karma into the place. And then after that, it was no problem. I mean, virtually everybody in town that had a little side act, like Izzy's had, I don't know if you remember any of these clubs, like Izzy had a strip club on Georgia Street. And all his dancing girls wanted to work for us. They wanted to go on the stage. They wanted to work for us. And all the acts that were like the magicians,
what would
the
they do?
Tumblers, the acrobats.
Would they sing?
They would sing. They would do stand-up comedy. They would do acrobatics. They would do exotic dancing. They would do whatever they
so
did
it was like
anywhere.
Burlesque. It was like
there was
a
total vaudeville burlesque thing, and the door was open. And basically, so I would run bad movies. You know, at that time, like Marx Brothers, it wasn't the hip thing. They were just old movies, right? So in between, before the movies, we'd do vaudeville. Between the movies, and then we'd get all these acts. They'd get to see all the acts that they had to pay money cover to see in the rest of the club. Well, Izzy got his nose really out of joint with that, and he called the union on us, and it was a whole bunch of craziness going on. And there was... So we, and that's basically what the program was. We had a wide open door, and then we were able to sort of, do as much live stuff as we could. And basically, these people were...
Did you see yourself as an impresario of sorts?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was basically it. I would show up in the morning, okay, 10 o'clock, open the theater, get the janitors working, right, and they start cleaning the place, right? And then I would start auditions, and then the people would come in. They'd usually be waiting in line. I'd have a cup of coffee and a cigar, and I'd sit there, and these potential acts would present themselves, and that would go from 10 to 12, right, for 2 hours. We'd do that, right? And then I would just, make notes, and then I would say, okay, you're on tonight, you're on tomorrow night, you're on this night, you're on that night. And I'd sort of try and book the week, right, and as much as I could. And then if I had to do auditions more than that, then, you know, it was thin. But I would try and just make do with whoever showed up. You were going to make it, you know. And
would you pay?
$5.
$5.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know,
the is that equivalent to $25 today?
Yeah, it would have been something like that. Yeah,
10, 15 minutes of.
You know, the thing was that it gave them a focus. These are people that were basically living on the street. Some of them, of course, were making better money than that with their acts, right? At Izzy's, but they'd work for us for $5 because they just wanted to get to have the experience of working that hall, and and it was what a great building. It had an orchestra pit, it had dressing rooms. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, basically, we were open to staging anything that there was no other stage for. You know, I mean, there was all kinds of things going on. There was all kinds of music going on in the street, like a lot of the street musicians. I mean, back then, there were street musicians everywhere. They were unregulated, so they were free to, you know, serenade you. They'd get together in groups, and it was like the Hare Krishnas were there. We had them come in one time and do a concert, you know, and but basically, like Al Neal, and then we had, you know, there was quite a few, like, you know, dance and performances. There was a group of artists from, you know, expatriates from everywhere, from Eastern Canada to you know, the U.S. Yeah, we had, you know, the thing was is that it was one of those things that we were judged essentially locally on the basis of the local productions that we staged. But we had an enormous, you know, international following. There was two major articles published on us in Variety. And we were the first theater in the world to actually make money screening the old movies.
Really?
And that would, they published that. So it was show business. It's a show business thing. And then we were the first theater to package all 5 Beatles movies. And that made Variety. In both cases, it cost us. Until we were published in Variety, I was getting those films for like $5 a week. Like Marx Brothers, Treasure of Sierra Madres, you know, all the old, beautiful old black and white Stagecoach. And then after that article came out.
So who was the audience?
The audience was basically, a large part of the audience was like American
expatriates,
right? And people from that were here from like out of town, Toronto, a lot of Toronto people. Anybody who was here from like North American show business was really tied in because Hugh Pickett, who was really active at that point, right, with the Playhouse and whatnot, right, and doing a lot of promotions and really was well connected. He was like, he loved it. He was there. He used to just come by at nights and take tickets for us because he just loved everything about it. He just thought it was the greatest experience. And he would invite like every celebrity that came into town, he would bring them virtually. And so we had this you know, kind of...
It was this mix of entertainment.
It was a mix of entertainment. It was absolutely, yeah. And he saw... That's right. The vaudeville stuff was what he...
We should do this again. I think this is...
Yeah, it was absolutely in keeping with the times. And then also, it's like, it was part of, like, it was almost an extension of what was going on. Partly with the intermedia and then with the Western Front and the creation of these crazy characters and the whole kind of like sort of appropriating that business. Like, like the way that I saw, you know, the media was able to be appropriated within that. I went out and I went into show business and I started to appropriate it. I took product that was on the shelf that was worthless and I reprocessed it, put a little pizzazz on it, and then made money with it.
Gave it a context
that made it now, right? And
you really made money?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Like,
well, I didn't. I,
like,
well,
what you, kind of money? Like $500 a month? You must have had a payroll.
Yeah, but it was like a very small payroll, right. And basically, you know, the thing was that we had a 750 seat. Theater.
Okay.
Say we charged a buck a head, right? And we filled a house, right? And you did that 7 nights a week, right? So over a month, you've got 30 times 750, right? So that's your month. So that's 25,000. Yeah, 25,000 bucks.
So you were filling the theater?
That's why we made variety.
Was it
like the Beatles? We ran those Beatles movies 7 days a week. We wore out Prince, and it was packed every night.
Well, the Beatles movies. When were they produced? They were produced in the late 60s.
Hard Day's Night, and then we had Hard Day's Night,
Yellow Submarine,
da 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 da, and right. Then whatever the
Sergeant Pepper.
Yeah.
I can't remember what the movies were now, but I mean.
And then Let It Be, and then. So that was like that was in our last year. It was like we just, you know.
And they had been run, and they were like all like.
They were available. Yeah,
they were several years old, and they were cheap.
Yeah, but there was not the industry wasn't organized the way it was. Like what happened was is that there was a whole series like everything went from 35 to 16, mm-hmm. And 16 millimeter was for schools, National Film Board, and weather ships. And the armed forces.
And you were doing 16.
And we were doing 16.
I see.
So we got, we could get the 16 millimeter prints of films that were still currently running in 35 and air them for next to nothing.
Right.
Right?
Gotcha.
Because no one was doing it. And so that's why we made, but they put an end to that when they started publishing all that information. But basically,
What was all this? Was that like where all these cushions were? What's all that about?
Well, when we took over, that someone had tried to remove the seats and was going to make this into some sort of a dance floor, and whether it was a city or somebody like that, right? And then they just quit because it just was, you know, impossible.
I wonder why.
Yeah, all the seats were still around, so we just put all the seats back.
Back.
We just put them all back. Yeah.
Oh, so this was
these very early.
Were taken very. I remember
very early
because it was a new thing.
Yeah,
and
that's
when
right.
I went there, you know, it was like, you know, you were getting used to the place, and it seemed very kind of like empty.
Yeah. It was. It wasn't anything later on that when we ended up like this was all painted.
Oh, and, you repainted.
Yeah,
we repainted everything.
We did the outside.
After that.
Yeah, and we did the all the sign and everything, and we painted the outside, and and it was funny because we painted it exactly the colors that Greenpeace adopted, the yellow and the green, and it was exactly those two colors.
So it was then it was removed and it was demolished.
It was demolished, yeah.
Was it the 80s? The beginning of the 80s?
No, then we were there for. Like between 69 and 73.
Okay.
So 4 years we were there, and then a year after that, I think it
went.
And then we moved out, and then shortly thereafter, it was gone. We were almost the last place still doing business there.
Pauline Johnson
was right next to us. And at that time, these were like just sections of seats that were around the building,
right,
stacked up upstairs and stuff. And we just
This is upstairs.
Yeah, on this was like there was four floors. We had four floors.
Up on what had they used the upper floors? That was like factory or office or something, eh?
Yeah, no, these were big empty spaces, just like you see here.
So they were, but I mean, they must have been used originally.
Well, yeah, they were all office space. Yeah, they were all four floors. Now the very top floor had a really high ceiling and it had big, gorgeous, curved, arched windows all the way around.
That's right. I have a picture of those arched windows.
Yeah, and that was where, that was like the studio for the guy that painted the signs.
Uh-huh.
For 30 years, he worked for the Quagliati family, right?
And he painted
all the posters.
All the posters.
And there was a trap door. You came up to the last level, right? And then there was a big trap door and you popped the trap door, and I remember we popped that trap door, and then there was a cloud of this sparkle dust.
Oh yeah,
because when he most of his posters, he would
sparkle.
Just covered in sparkle dust, right? And the sun coming through, and it was like, whoa, we're in heaven, you know, what a trip. And then it drifted down, we're all covered in it. Oh, just fantastic.
Interesting. Right? Well, there's a few other pictures in this series, and one of them is, I guess it's Wally shining a flashlight on this rounded window upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it was like stained glass or something.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, on the front. Yeah, I don't think you can see that. And we restored all that. And I mean, labor of love.
You like, spent money on it.
We spent a lot of money on it. I mean, it just got to be, these were all stained glass, flaming stained glass. Mm-hmm. There was, and the outside, we got the sign working 100%. Every bulb was replaced, got all the electrical sorted out, and it would just do everything.
Fantastic.
And it was just a complete source of pride because we constantly were getting, encouragement from, L.A., from New York, from Toronto. People were coming in, and we had all these celebrities that were coming around saying, wow, this is fantastic, like that Alan J. Lerner, the playwright, wanted contacted us and wanted to do a play based on the theater.
Really?
He wanted to do that. And that was sort of in the works,
uh-huh,
you know. And
uh-huh.
Ann Southern wanted to produce a TV show right from there. And
wow.
And Hugh Pickett had it all organized. And they got a CBC director to come in at the last minute and polish the whole thing up. You know, mm-hmm. Or it took away exactly.
So they did. They did it.
And well, no, the what happened was it turned out to be like Ann Mortifee,
mm-hmm.
who was to be discovered, discovered by Ann Southern and sang on as part of the thing. And Ann Southern got up after her performance, still in the middle of the show. And was just screaming with delight and running towards the stage. And she missed the step and fell flat in her face and just about bounced onto the stage, you know. But she recovered and she grabbed onto Anne and just held onto her.
Uh-huh.
Like, oh, I got this, my discovery. I got this one. This is mine. Oh, my God. She was just thrilled, you know. Poor little Anne was like, what's going on, you know. And so they, you know, so then after that, it was all like, you know, then after that, all her and the executives and everything. And then, you know, Anne was like, oh, you know, she was going out with Wally at the time, right? So she was sort of part of the family. And she said, no. And they say, well, you know, and then they say, well, look, it, you know, without her, there is no show.
Right.
Well, there is no show.
Uh-huh.
Hit it, you know. And, that was it. So then he would call back over and over again. I'm really disappointed. You know, this is, you know, they still keep calling me. You know, so that was. But that was the kind of thing that happened every day. I mean, you know, it was always
A real soap opera. Right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was great. I mean, you know, to a certain degree, being in show business is not. You know, it's like.
Well, it's live.
Yeah.
Basically, that's
it's a very much alive, you know. And the thing is that you don't, you know, we had such a you know, like a solid kind of foundation of people that really, you either loved us or you didn't, you know, and there was, and if you loved us, like, for example, on Grey Cup, you know, night, right, and there was rioting on the streets, right, and they were running up and down Granville Street. Well, we're Granville and Dunsmuir, right? The BC Lions, you know, 7 or 8 of them came down to the theater to protect it. And we thought, oh, what's going on? You know, what's going on? We went downstairs and we saw all these thugs in the thing. We thought, holy Jesus. And like, nobody's going to hurt this place. You know, and, oh, that's wonderful. You know, but strange.
And
like,
you never got busted?
No.
No.
Never.
Never in
never.
The theater?
Yeah, no. And, you know, the thing is that we had, at one point, Chilliwack was rehearsing in the theater. We'll talk about it loud.
Yeah.
Right. So they're there during the day and they're cranking their equipment up, right? Places on the corner, and there was a company called Lever Arms. It was a gun dealer, mm-hmm. and he was on Dunsmuir Street, right across the street from us, right? And he could hear the noise, and he kept making complaints to the police. Now he thought he had pull with the police, right? But
you had more pull.
That there was somebody on our side at City Hall that was you know,
this was a worthwhile thing
yeah. and
you have to put up with a little
a little noise and that, and there is no
the big picture.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so there was always a lot of resentment there, so we never we never got over that, and he sort of like, you know, who's got the most pull. But then, you know, so there was that, you know, side of it. But basically, we attracted all the businesses around there. I mean, he was the exception. But all the businesses around on that lower part of the street where it goes down there benefited from us. Because attracted a lot of people. It opened that end of the street up, which was kind of shut down at that point, you know. So
do you have a film or video or anything like that of that era?
Gary... at the time had a friend who was teaching art at St. George's Boys School. Mm-hmm. And as a project, this guy got the class to come down for probably a month. They would come down in groups, and they took Super 8, they took slides, they took video, they did recordings. And they collected it all together, and they made a massive show. And then there was like a 2-hour show, and they did a multi-screen projection show at the school. And we got invited to it, and I mean, it just nailed it. It was fantastic. There was Al's music was there, you know, Al Neal and Screeching. I mean, that was like, the whole auditorium. Just every time he came on, they were just
Any more of that?
No, yeah, and I don't know that it's probably part of their archives, you know, I would think. I don't know.
Have you seen Al's LP? Not LP, it's a CD, their compilation CD?
No. '65 to '68. Okay, yeah. So this is now what is this played? Is this concerts at the Cellar or?
It's a variety of stuff.
Compilation.
So it's you know, for all I know, it's there's stuff from the Magic Theater.
And Well, '68. It would have been.
The end. It's. 68 is the end of it?
Oh, I don't know. That's what it says, 65 to 68.
Oh, okay. So it's prior to.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a two LP set here.
Well, 66, yeah. Well, there's that poster that was on the front of the theater for our inaugural, which must have been 69.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this was organized by this fellow here, Richard Anstey.
Yeah, yeah.
From, I think he lives in Germany or something like that.
Well, he was a member of the band, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was a member of the band.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.